Thank Next slide. Is it why it's not changing? Hello?
Hi, there is a slight delay. Are you seeing the timing of difficulties in military families?
I'm not seeing anything on my screen other than the old slide. But what I can do is pull it up on my project on my own screen that I have, like the PowerPoint, and I'll speak from that. And if it's so, we have lessons learned from the Desert Storm. Is that up presently?
No, it's
One
the one
second.
right after that. It's on
Okay.
timing of
All right.
difficulties.
Great. Okay. One of the things to know, we have many lessons from Operation Desert Storm, and a lot of people in the lay world believe that the big trauma happens with the deployment. Yes, there's grief and crying and upset, but the real difficulties that people would see in families and in schools are actually toward the end of the deployment. Now, this is particularly important for us today because we have very long deployments and we have recycling deployments, which are essentially just ongoing waves of this phenomenon. And one of the reasons it's most difficult toward the end of the deployment is that the support from the community, the larger military ability to provide support, begins to wane during the course of the deployment. May I have the next slide, please? And you can confirm it with to me that that's happened.
Yes,
So,
we're.
okay, great. So we have military family health care. One of the things also to notice is that that previous slide suggests that we would see many more health care visits among the family members, particularly the adults, who are at home after reunion, and that is indeed what we see. So we have to think about this is the issues at hand are not limited to just while the children or while the family has a deployment, an active deployment. Next, please. So, one of the things that we've been able to show is that deployment from the continental United States, that's CONUS, during Desert Storm, we had very clear evidence of elevated symptom problems of depression among children and their parents. We also saw significantly more intervening depression stressors with children than non-deployed folks, and boys and younger children appeared to be especially affected. Next, please. And confirm with me that we have German Desert Storm deployment.
Yep, it's up.
Great. Okay. About 40% of the children on the U.S. military installations in Germany develop post-traumatic stress symptoms. And this was my testimony before Congress. And one of the things to know is that we saw regression among young children. They became whinier. They wouldn't do new things. They clung to adults. They became very dependent. But with older kids, we saw aggression, sexual behavior, stealing, drugs, and classic externalizing things. And amongst the adults, alcohol sales stayed the same in the PXs in January after 100,000 service members were deployed in December. So a lot of adults were self-medicating. We are convinced that many of these things are happening today with our families. Next, please. Now we have data from the war on terrorism, which I'd like to alert you to because there are some different issues. And this is getting us into modern context. In the immediate surrounds of the Pentagon and in the areas around the Pentagon in terms of Virginia, Maryland, et cetera, we actually saw significant increases in the number of visits for anxiety disorders and acute stress reactions in children who were not even directly affected by the attacks or did not even have folks in the military. So it's important to understand that the impact of these things are, in fact, contagious to children, and there are evolutionary reasons why that's so. Okay, next, please. We also know that parental and child problems are actually objectively showing up in military-sponsored studies. We're seeing higher levels of parenting stress. 32% of the families, for example, report very high risk for psychosocial morbidity, and 42% report for high risk on a parenting stress form. So you've got a problem of both a third of the kids are showing up with quite a lot of externalizing or internalizing behaviors that will contaminate everyday interactions in school and academic success, as well as the parents themselves will have a great deal of distress which interact with one another. Next, please. But I want you to see this in the context of broader American trends, because it might be that there are other things going on in America that are exacerbating the very things that are happening to military families and are, in fact, also happening with our children right now who have no involvement with the military. So next, please. So, for example, when we had the Oklahoma bombing, it was proven that the children who had no contact with students in that or families in the immediate Oklahoma City thing were affected by the bombing, and those children and adolescents reported emotional and physical things lower just from watching the television, and post-traumatic stress symptoms. Now, why that's important is that children today, about 60 or 70% of children have a television in their in the child's bedroom. And that means that our children, be they military or non-military, are developing these kinds of PTSD-like, not full-blown, but very clear symptomatology from watching violence and threat on television. And that will make all of these problems worse, and it actually suggests a therapeutic intervention, which is to reduce the exposure of television in children's bedrooms, and we have very good evidence experimentally that that intervention alone will increase sleep, which will reduce the psychiatric symptoms, and reduce externalizing aggressive behavior as well at school, which is very good, and actually improve academic achievement. So this is one of the fundamental things to remember when you're working on this, is to organize the school climate and community about not having televisions in children's bedrooms. There is not a single scientific study that shows placing a television in a child's bedroom is beneficial. There are a few that show that it's not necessarily harmful, but the bulk show serious harm, and this is an invisible factor. Next, please. We have large increases in depression, bipolar, and anxiety, and suicidality are happening already in young people in America. Some of these rates have doubled or tripled within the span of approximately 10 or 15 years, and this is background influence, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why that's so and what that means for us in the school environment of how we counteract this. And of course, this will be worsened among kids who are affected by a deployment. We have clear evidence, next please, of ADHD and conduct disorders and cutting increasing in youth today. Yes, there may be overdiagnosis of ADHD, but it's also objectively clear that it's increasing, and early ADHD is a predictor of worsening symptoms for the deployment, et cetera. We already know that in TRICARE, the rates of prescription scripts for ADHD medication has skyrocketed since the war on terror, as well as the use of psychotropics for depression, et cetera. Next, please. Serious addictions are happening at a younger age in America, and that's been going on for about 15 years. We now have children with cirrhosis of the liver who are adolescents, 18, 16, 17, which never really happened before. And now remember the comment that during the Gulf War deployment that alcohol consumption stayed the same in the PXs even when 100,000 people were no longer there. So what people do, and this was confirmed in the 9/11 attacks, is that people use a lot of alcohol to temporarily replace some of the serotonergic and status functions of native biochemistry of humans, but this actually has countervailing and bad effects on everyone concerned. The next, please. We are seeing, this is on prescription meds, about twice as many American youth are on psychotropic medications as are children in Germany and the Netherlands, respectively. And what's interesting is that those two countries have more of the very specific behavioral vaccines or evidence-based kernels that are easily accessible to every teacher in those countries or to every parent. And so my plea for you today is to begin organizing our communities so that the same kinds of evidence-based practices, which are very low cost, which were actually invented in America, are being used by our economic competitors, who are available to our children and families. Now, our next slide is, how can we provide support given the context that we know that the deployment is having major effects, and that we also have this background of other things that are affecting our young people. So my question to you folks is a little bit, has anyone seen these phenomena of these increasing trends? And if so, just give me a little feedback in the questions and answers column that you've seen some of these trends. That will be helpful to me, because I'm going very quick, mindful that we have to do a lot of this in a short period of time. Next slide, please. We should have evidence-based kernels are the smallest unit of behavioral influence. There are antecedent kernels, which happen before things. There are reinforcement kernels that happen after a behavior has occurred. And there are physiological kernels that can be done either before, after, or doing events, which have profound effects on the issues that we're talking about. And then there are languaging interventions that can have a major impact on all of the behaviors, the diagnoses that our young people, both in the military and not in the military, are having. And these need to have some attention. Those are called relational frames. By the way, we have made available, the next slide, please, the paper that's on evidence-based kernels, freely available. And you may circulate it without fear of copyright, because my author and I have actually purchased the copyright laws back to put it in open source. Now, where can kernels be found? Well, we've identified many of these low-cost, simple procedures in major journals in the United States. From the Journal of the American Medical Association, we will pick up one kernel that is very powerful, for example, in helping the parents and the other caregiving adults. There's some from Science Magazine, from Prevention Medicine, from the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis and Developmental Psychology. These are all among the most prestigious journals in the United States. The next slide, please. What is a kernel? Well, a kernel is the smallest unit of scientifically proven behavioral influence. It's the active ingredient of many evidence-based programs. It's indivisible. If you take something away from this very small unit, it doesn't work anymore. It stops being active. You could think of it as the active ingredient in an over-the-counter or prescription medication. It produces typically quick effects that can grow to be much bigger. So most of the evidence-based kernels that I'll be mentioning, you will be able to see an effect in a classroom within a day or maybe even minutes. But the cumulative effect of these things can be extraordinarily powerful in reducing DSM-IV symptoms, as well as preventing those very symptoms from happening in the first place. They can be used alone or in combination as a sort of recipe. So many of the things that I'm talking about take very little time. So, you know, fasten your seat belts and all that. This is not going to cause you to have to adopt a big expensive program, etc. Now, the next slide is, this is the actual article which was published in Clinical Child and Family Psychology Review on evidence-based kernels. And let me show you what kernels can increase in your setting. So you should have a slide that says, kernels can increase academic success, positive behavior, resiliency skills. Resiliency skills would have an enormous impact on our children who were affected by the deployment. Emotional regulation, self-discipline, goal setting, cooperation and teamwork, entrepreneurial skills, nurturing families and parenting, better schools, and much more. But I want you to also pay attention to that the same kernels can sometimes be used to decrease various things, such as on the next slide, academic failure, dropping out of school, learning disability, ADHD, oppositional defiance, depression, bipolar disorder, violence, aggression, bullying, delinquency, crime, tobacco, alcohol, and drug use, and harsh negative parenting. So next slide, please. Let me give you an example. By the way, I have no screen refresh of any kind, so I cannot see if we've had any questions. So I'm going to depend on you, Ben, to tell me, do we have any questions at this point?
Nope, it doesn't look like we have any yet.
Okay, all right. So I don't know why I'm not getting screen refresh, but I'm not going to pause for rebooting the GoToMeeting. Let's see. So you should have a slide up that says beat the timer for families. Now, I don't know how many of you have a timer at home, but you probably do on a stove or a microwave. But we're talking here about a pocket timer, the kind that you get, you know, at Target or Walmart or Walgreens. And this is a small electronic kitchen timer, the dial-up one that's shown here. There are 17 studies on the use of beat the timer in classroom for families. One of the most difficult things that families, military families, report during the deployment is getting kids to complete tasks that are important for family well-being. That might mean picking up their toys, getting ready for school, getting ready for bed, doing homework, doing other chores. Beat the timer is a powerful procedure to help families. So, for example, and we have a video that we're producing on this right now. For example, a parent sets the timer for a specific amount of time, typically a short period of time, and then announces that the timer is on, and then praises a child for doing some of the tasks. So, for instance, if the child is picking up their toys to get ready to go to school, which is a very stressful time for families who are affected by deployment, the parent then praises the child. Thank you, Kit. You know, John, for putting the white Power Ranger into the toy box. For those of you who don't know, the white Power Ranger is the most desirable Power Ranger there is, and children want to play with it forever. So what you're doing is immediately reinforcing compliance for an important family routine. And then when the timer rings, if the child has beat the timer, parents or teachers typically give a choice of a surprise reward. So the child dips their hand in a paper bag or some kind of pail for what are called mystery motivators that are fun things that the child can do that don't necessarily cost any money. So, for example, the child might win a piggyback ride to the car or might get to choose what radio station or CD is put in the car's radio, or sit in the front seat, or small things like that. These small, stressful events are what predict child maltreatment, which has been shown to go up, and it is up among our military families. So that is an example of an antecedent kernel that can be used at home. Now, in the classroom, it's a very useful procedure to use, because one of the things that happens with children who experienced these traumas is that they have two reactions. They start to freeze and become sort of fearful about doing anything, or they become overreactive to any adult instruction. So a teacher in any of your environments can use beat the timer to improve academic engagement, reduce transition time, because transition time is when the children will pick on each other, poke each other, and cause secondary trauma that the adults do not see. And you can dramatically reduce transition time and gain several weeks of instruction just by using beat the timer, and actually improve academic achievement and ADHD symptoms. So if there are questions about beat the timer, I'll be happy to answer that. Typically, you want to get a good electronic timer. They cost somewhere around $6 to $10. Next slide, please. This is an adult-to-child praise note kernel. Typically, these are done on sheets of paper or NCR paper. And if you are in a school or after-school organization, by the way, beat the timer, all of these can be used typically at home, at school, and after-school settings. So adults in the organized settings like school or after school are given the instruction to notice two children per week, possibly more under highly stressful circumstances. They should notice one child who has made an improvement this past week, and they should notice a child who has been steady this past week. And it's best if these are done on NCR paper, because one can be given to the child to take home, another copy can be posted on the wall, another copy can be sent to the principal or administrator's office for announcements on the public address system, etc. These simple adult-to-child praise notes have been shown to reduce major psychiatric problems, both from internalizing and externalizing behavior. They have also been shown to reduce physical illness in children and adults. And that is a very important finding, because the prolonged stress hormones that are associated with the deployment and the fear thereto actually cause the immune system to be overreactive and have a hyper-generalized immune system response. So this is a small, powerful procedure, and we have the actual forms and directions that you can do with that. Next one. And by the way, these are more powerful if across the community or across the base the same forms are used. They have more reinforcing value, and one of the reasons you need to do this something like this is under conditions of perceived threat and depression that the adults are under, they tend to praise and reinforce pro-social positive behavior in children less, and they pay more attention to negative behavior and disturbing disruptive behavior, which actually creates a sort of black hole of problems. The next slide, which is on peer-to-peer praise note kernel. Again, this has about 10 studies on it, and what this is that the students or children at home, at school, in an after-school program, or even in organized therapeutic settings, learn to write positive notes to one another. I'm here at a site visit for our juvenile violent offender reentry project, and we do this with these young people here. And so the students are taught how to do it. By the way, we have some cute names. You'll notice in the slide there it says a tootle, and a tootle is the opposite of a tattle. Tattling goes way up among children who are exposed to trauma and difficulties. So these are put up and changed approximately every week or two. The children get to take them home. One of the things that this does is increase a sense of belonging and safety, which we've been able to objectively measure in studies. It also reduces illnesses in children, and it works for children 5 to 18. In fact, it's also very useful for adults. We would recommend that this be done at a school level, not just for the children, but for the adults paying attention to one another for their positive things. We have evidence to suggest that it also reduces ADHD symptomatology. The next slide is an alternative seating thing to reduce ADHD. While I'm a licensed child and developmental psychologist, I am always reluctant to place children on medication, which unfortunately is happening at very high frequency in America, because people do not know about other interventions that have very sound science. So one of the things that you will see is lots of inattentive behavior in a classroom from children exposed to trauma. And everyone leaps to believe that the child has ADHD. They do not. ADHD behaviors under those circumstances are about recognizing potential threats to the child, even though you can say as an adult, no, that's not threatening. The hard biology wires the child to have distractibility, to look for human threats, since the principal threat to humans for the last several hundred thousand years, perhaps maybe more than that, maybe 1.5 million years since the invention of stone tools, have been actually other humans. So when you place a child on a therapy ball like the child is sitting there, you dramatically reduce disruptive, disturbing behavior and inattentive behavior in the classroom, but you also actually increase academic responding, high quality academic responding. If you take away the ball, it goes back down. Now you're probably going to go, well, why the heck does that work? Well, we have a pretty good idea. If you understand how the medication works, the medication attaches to the back of the brain, an area called the cerebellum. In particular, it attaches to an area called the vermis. And that vermis controls goal setting, attention, and voluntary goal-related behaviors. It is highly disrupted under conditions of perceived threat. And it also movement in, stimulates the vermis area and releases something called brain-derived neurofactor, which you could think of as brain fertilizer. If the child has this motoric stimulation and they have the BDNF and the stimulation of the vermis, that orients them toward the goal of academic responding, reduces distractibility. And in Switzerland, by the way, there are cantons, which are the equivalent of counties or states, that where these are universally accessible to all children. And by the way, one of the symptoms that you will notice of children from trauma, who have trauma-induced ADHD, is that they have motor overflow in their legs. Pay attention to what their legs are doing. You know, it's the kind of fidgeting, jiggliness, and they are attempting to self-medicate, and often adults say, don't do that, and they get harsher and harsher in saying, don't do that. And that actually worsens the symptoms. Next, please. You have something here, a little graph with this kid with green hair. And this is a brief motivational interview. One of the things that happens for any person exposed to chronic stress and trauma and the fear of violence and loss is the loss of a future orientation. And loss of future orientation is particularly dangerous because what it does is increases, well, it reduces delay in reinforcement. So kids will take the most immediate reinforcer, which might be drugs, sex, rock and roll, whatever, is immediately reinforcing. And that's Mother Nature speaking, saying, take the money and run. So you have to do intentional interventions to orient children toward a future as well as adults. The brief motivational interviewing thing is a map, excuse me, which I'll show you in the next thing. And it works for children as young as second grade, and it works for people anything above that. Next, please, which is an actual physical one. Here it is. You can see the actual form that is used, where you discuss with a person what is their goal, what is something heartfelt that they'd like to achieve in the future, and typically give them a frame, either a short-term goal or a longer-term goal. And then you ask them why is that or what about that goal is important to them. And what you want to get to are the emotional reasons, not the monetary reasons, but the really heartfelt reasons that this goal is in, makes their eyes light up. Look for how they change their body posture when they talk about something, and that'll begin to tell you. Then the next thing is to talk about who can help them. Now, people will always list under conditions of stress a very small number of potential helpers. Now, that's natural for stress, but what you want to do is to suggest other alternatives. Oh, well, could Mrs. So-and-so help you? Or as in the case of a young man that I was working with, he wanted to be an EMT or fireman, and I suggested, do you know a fireman or an EMT? And then he averred that he did, and he knew a captain of a fire station down the way. And we then talked about being a volunteer and that the captain could write him a letter of reference, and this is a 17-year-old young man. And he asks, what is a letter of reference? So you can tell what happens when kids get exposed to trauma. Their worldview gets inscribed. Then what you want to do is specifically begin to ask about steps that they could do. Their initial orientation towards steps will be way too large. So in the case of the young man that you want, we were discussing this with, I asked him, what's something you could do today or tomorrow related to your goal about going to Northern Arizona University to become an EMT or fireman? And he said, eventually, with a little bit of prompting, get the phone number and call the captain at the fire station. That's precisely the kind of thing you want to get, because then you can reinforce it as caregiving adults or caring adults. Then you want to discuss things that could get in the way, which is the bottom one, the barriers, and that may be bad habits, for example, laying in bed at night watching television, how that's helping them, and who people for whom you could begin to find solutions to those barriers. All right? This is a very powerful procedure, and we can send you some nice studies on it and as well as some procedures. Let's go to the next one, which is emotional writing for adults. It is very important that we have an appropriately sympathetic and empathetic view of the adults who are affected. And by the way, just getting antidepressants will not improve the parenting or teaching skills of the people who are affected by the deployment. But something like emotional writing, which this study appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Excuse me, I'm going to cough. I'm back on. Where people write 3 to 4 times about the most significant painful thing that's happened to them in their lives. They write about the same thing 4 times in the span of about a week to 10 days. Sometimes they write about different things. They do not show what they write to a therapist. They do not show it to anybody else. It's private. And it turns out in 50-some studies that this activity of emotional writing, it is not like diarying, although there are some similarities to it, or journaling, because you're actually confronting the very pain. And often current trauma, current events evoke memories of old traumas that then cause a rapid increase unconsciously of the stress hormones that dysregulate thoughts, dysregulate the immune system, which is why under the circumstances when it was done, that the need for healthcare visits went down, and there's a companion study that shows that actual use of prescription medications went down. So here's another one in the next one. You should see omega-3 fatty acid fish oil for DSM-4 diagnoses. I just have returned from a meeting that was convened as an invited guest, as an invited scientist to a meeting involving the U.S. Department of Defense and the National Institutes of Health, about making sure that we have an appropriate level of omega-3 fatty acids in our service members, because if you have high levels of omega-6, which are found in soybean oil, cottonseed oil, et cetera, which among the base food services and the PX food services are extraordinarily asymmetric in the appropriate fatty acid ratios, and when there's too much omega-6 and too little omega-3, we're more likely to see post-traumatic stress disorder. We're more likely to see trauma responses. We're more likely to see suicide. We're more likely to see high levels of aggression, ADHD, bipolar disorder, and intellectual impairment and poor physical performance. So this is something that the Department of Defense is aware of and beginning to take action. Our children and of military families and their spouses of deployed military will also be deficient. We are almost certain of that because of national data. Here's a recipe, which I will not spend a great deal of time, but if you actually increase the biological availability of omega-3 fatty acid, which has been reported in the Institute of Medicine report, reported in the American Psychiatric Association as a consensus recommendation. I underscore that. The American Psychiatric Association, by consensus recommendation, says that every psychiatric or psychological patient should receive not less than 1 full gram per day of omega-3 fatty acid to abate and mitigate against the symptomatology. Here is the recipe on the one that says example support info about what the dose is to meet that recommendation. Some may need more than that. We are happy to provide the papers. for this. By the way, if you're in an institutional setting, this is a food item. It is not a medication or a drug. It is an FOOD. And therefore, you can also change the recipes. We have data and information on how you can alter a school lunch program to provide the appropriate dietary ratios that are similar to what is being planned for the garrison food in U.S. military bases in the United States. Next, please. You should see a physical activity journal. Young people and the adults today have vastly less physical exercise and activities. So this is reducing brain-derived neurofactor that interferes with appropriate memory formation. It interferes with the ability to learn from experience to engage in new learning. And a lot of people don't let their children play outside now for fear of God knows what, violence, terrorism, et cetera, fear of something bad will happen to their children because of media. And this is actually increasing all of the underlying problems and will be even worse among our military families and their children. So this is something that we would want to think about. Next slide, please. Institute of Medicine. I'd like to briefly review with you a couple of things that have been reported on March 25th in the Institute of Medicine report on the prevention of mental, emotional, and behavioral disorders among young people. This is an extraordinary document. So for the first time, the highest levels of scientific investigators and policymakers in this country have declared that almost every DSM-IV diagnosis is, in fact, preventable. This is not common knowledge, and if you Google prevention in bipolar, prevention in ADHD, et cetera, you will see on the most leading websites today, which are sadly mostly funded by the pharmaceutical industry, that prevention is not possible, only manageable. That is not true. So the next slide shows you something that I would like to encourage everyone to do in their communities, which is provide universal parenting support. Remember early on in the slides that we saw that the parenting distress is very high, and what we tend to do is wait, and we make a participation in parenting support shame-based and illness-based rather than positive and reactive. 30% of all doctor's office visits under normal populations of people to pediatricians or family practice physicians involve requests for parenting advice from the attending or from the a physician's assistant. Right now, there are only two things the physician's assistant or doctor can say. It's a phase, I'll grow out of it, or two, take these meds. When you do something called triple P, that stands for positive parenting thing, what you see up here is there can be universal messages about parenting support, like demonstrating and showing the use of Beat the Timer. There can be selected very brief 20, 30-minute interventions at a doctor's office, any kind of an agency that teaches these sorts of things. It could be at school, it could be at church, it could be an after-school program that teach these very brief interventions. You do not have to be a licensed clinician to deliver these things. There can also be some primary care ones that involve a little bit more complexity, maybe two or three problems solved, or there can be parenting courses. What we were able to show in the first population-level study in the world to prevent child maltreatment is that the top three things up there, one, two, and three, and a little bit of four, nothing on five for high-strength interventions, were able to prevent child maltreatment at a population level. This would result in thousands fewer children in the military having the experience of being maltreated. And this cost approximately $15 per child to engineer, and we have provided the hyperlinks to learn more about this at the end. There's multiple studies on this, and the next thing is two population level proofs. This is completely different than the way we normally provide parenting support. It's premised on the idea that every parent deserves support, not those bad parents over there. So this is a radical departure, but very powerful. The countries that have very low level of parenting problems and child maltreatment do make this universally accessible, like the Netherlands, like Germany. The next slide actually shows an example of a calculation. We have a website that will allow you to calculate the benefit of this in every single state in the union, and that will be on a website address at the end of the presentation. The next intervention, and I'm almost finished with my questions, is a thing for the whole class that combines something called the good behavior game, which is reinforcing cooperation, attention, and voluntary control over the attention circuitry invented by a fourth grade teacher. That was been shown in multiple studies, next long-term proof, to reduce every major psychiatric disorder that you can think of, including suicide. And it's something that enables a teacher to have 26% more time for instruction, reduces the need for special ed and special services by 30% almost immediately, and is something that can be learned and deployed very quickly for about the cost of $10. I'm going to skip the next slide, which shows an implementation in 14 different schools and 43 classrooms, showing reductions in disturbing and disrupting and ADHD behavior. Slide 42 is the recipe for it, which you can read offline, and we are happy to give you advice on how to set this up. We have it running ongoing studies at Johns Hopkins, and this is exactly the sort of intervention that reduces the intensification of the trauma response. We're doing these studies in Baltimore, where everyday trauma is chronic, and the transformation of children from having the symptomatology is nothing short of remarkable. And this is also in the Institute of Medicine report. Finally, what we're also doing is, you see, what if all of this, we made this widely available? We're building a special website that will make all of these kinds of tools easily available, like iTunes or Amazon.com and YouTube. And next slide, coming soon, you'll be able to see this at simplegifts.com. And finally, last slide, there's our follow-up and time for questions. I felt like the traveling salesman.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much. That was a very fresh way to show how very simple and practical ways can be used to support kids and military families or others. So thank you very much for a very, very informative presentation. I want to make sure that we have, before we get to Beth talking about some of the resources at the very end, I want to make sure we have some time for some questions. So Ben, if you could please unmute so that anyone can jump in and ask a question.
I don't see any questions. I'm not getting any updates, so I don't know if there was any written ones or not.
No written. So, Ben, if we could unmute the phones, and anyone of the participants can just jump in and ask one over the phone.
Yep, their lines are unmuted.
Yeah, they're all unmuted.
Psychologist is in.
Let me ask a question, Dennis,
okay.
and that is looking at how beautifully simple all this kind of is to help our young people. What do you think are some of the best ways to convince our schools and communities to incorporate these kernels, these approaches to help our young people?
That is an excellent question. My suggestion is that you download or view the Prevention for All video and show that to people. That video has been shown to the cabinet. It's actually specifically requested by the governor's office of Ohio, and was shown to all the cabinet secretaries and the deputy secretaries, and that resulted in a unanimous vote by the cabinet to proceed to make all of these things available to families in Ohio. A similar thing has happened in the state of Washington just recently. A similar thing happened in Arkansas and in Maine. So the video lets people get a very clear way of seeing that all of this is in fact possible. And with the follow-on materials, the actual PowerPoint, the actual documents, then we can move forward. Because people just don't believe it. They think it's too good to be true. But it's too good not to be true, actually.
So to take a look at the Prevention for Everyone video, they just need to go to the YouTube site that's on the screen.
Yes, exactly.
Are we going to be emailed these websites?
We can do that.
Okay.
And we can send a hyperlink so that you can directly download the full video.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for, I think, because I'm not writing I wasn't writing them down, and I didn't know if I needed to be.
Yeah, the full download is about 500 megabytes, so do it when you go home from work.
Okay.
And Dennis, in high definition. Yes.
Dennis, one of our participants noted that she had 42 families that they knew of that had members in the military. And there are so many out there that we don't really know of. But I think your approach really was talking about helping many children, no matter if they had members in the military or not. The stress and the grief and the loss impacts us all, no matter where it comes from.
That is correct. And I have a philosophy that's come about from doing – I'm both a clinician and a prevention scientist. So my first recommendation to people is always mow the lawn. What that means is if you don't mow the lawn, everything looks like a weed. Everything looks like a DSM-4 diagnosis. But when you mow the lawn with these simple things, the true weeds stand out, and you can devote your resources to it intelligently and intensively. I hear somebody laughing about that. So.
Let me turn this over to Beth before we wrap up. Beth Freeman is going to very quickly walk us through some of the resources, some of the additional resources. Beth?
Yes. Thank you, John. Colleen is going to place on the screen for you three pages of resources will be sent. This information to as well as the PowerPoint presentation with the web links that you'll be able to use and further your studies on this topic. But as you see in front of you, I have highlighted some that are really good for you to look at. One of them under pre-deployment and post-deployment, you will see the So Far Guide. It actually has group studies and group information for to use in schools, whether you are a school counselor or a mental health professional, school psychologist, or a teacher. It can be used for any of you in this. And then also in the post-deployment, there are the NASP dialogues, military families and the reintegration process. This is a good resource for psychologists and others to work with children who have had the experience of times of war and terrorism. Then there's some good fact sheets in these handouts, and I've highlighted the tips for helping your child after deployment or homecoming after deployment. These are one-page or two-page handouts that can be given out in school, and you'll be able to access help for families or parents that come into your office, or maybe it would be just good information to give out at a faculty meeting where some of the teachers may find that they could give this out to some of the families that they work with. And then under injury and death, if we move down a little bit, you will see that caring for kids after trauma and death, a lot of our children unfortunately will experience the loss of a parent. And these are some good tips for helping teachers and family members know how to take care of their children and teens. And then there's some resources for educators and parents. One that is especially timely for this time of year is supporting young children during the holidays. And also resilience in a time of war, tips for parents and daycare providers, a guide for parents and teachers of middle school children, and then understanding child traumatic stress, which Dennis has spent a lot of time talking to us about how to decrease that stress. But there's guides for parents and toolkits, and also how to take care of yourself as a parent left home with a young child or a guardian left with the children while their parents are deployed. And as you know, as we move further down, there are many families come back to the community, and there are not any resources for them in their community because there's not a Veterans Administration nearby. So there are some ways that you can reach your community mental health resources. One thing that I thought was real interesting was that the same sky sharing and the good behavior game, which Dennis talked about, are really good resources and tools for counselors and mental health professionals and teachers to use with their children in small group settings. And that also has an interactive interactive time with the deployed family member as well. So it's a good way for students to stay in touch with their loved ones overseas. As you go down, there's also working with military children. It's a primer for school personnel, you see highlighted there. And then last but not least, as you move down, you will see there are some good articles and good other resources. There's a film, PBS film, The Next Mission, that talks about what the VA and the Veterans Administration is doing for our servicemen and their families as you come back. You have the Mental Health Services Locator, a state map, and resources located there as well. So we have tried to find many resources for you that might meet your particular needs, and that's all I have now. But I also would like to ask you, as you evaluate this webinar today, please give us feedback so that we can use your feedback to improve our future webinars. Thank you.
Well, and our time is up, and with that, I would like to thank very much Dr. Dennis Embry for joining us, an excellent presentation, and thank the team at the National Center for putting this together. And just to let you know, as participants, you will have access to what we did on the promoteprevent.org website. Ben, any last words?
I have a thing I'd just like to say. Thank you all for tuning in, participating. Many do not realize that about 70% of all of our current military come from military families. So what we do to help the children today will ensure our defense and the stability of our national security. This is not just now. It is for all of our futures. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Thank you, folks, and we'll be talking with you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.